third case of the morning, United States versus Eddie Carter. Sam Doerr? Let's wait till they get settled over there, if you will.
Good morning. My name is Linda Amder. I am court-appointed to represent Eddie Rainey Carter. Mr. Carter was convicted of two bank robberies. One occurred at the First Start Bank on North Kedzie in Chicago on September the 1st, 2001, that was charged in count one. The second concerned the First American Bank of Melrose Park. That robbery occurred on September the 4th, 2001. Mr. Carter was arrested immediately after the First American Bank robbery in Melrose Park. It is the First Star Bank robbery of September the 1st, 2001, which is the subject of this appeal. One teller, 3 months after the bank robbery of the First Star Bank, identified Mr. Carter from a photo array that had been presented, had been prepared by the FBI. That was shown to that particular witness on the date of December the 5th. That is in our brief, and that is the second photo array. The government had no other eyewitnesses. The admission of the December 5th, 2001 out-of-court identification by the government witness denied Mr. Carter a fair trial. The defense argued both in the district court and is arguing in this court that the identification made 3 months after the robbery was the direct result of an impermissibly suggestive photo array that was shown to that witness 5 days after the robbery. And that is the first photograph.
You're saying that the first display contaminated the view of the second display?
Yes.
Because he could look at the first display and then find the two, one common person in it, and then you could...
No, I think there's far more at stake at this. The first display contained six photographs. If we look at those photographs, we will see that two of the photographs on the back row have a darkened background, almost to the point that the viewer doesn't even see the person portrayed in the photograph. We see that Mr. Carter is in the very center of that array. He is wearing a white T-shirt. It flows into the background, the white background of the entire array. Our position is that that is an unduly suggestive array. It was prepared by the Chicago Police Department. It was shown to him on September the 6th. We believe that, assuming that the witness did not see the robber, that in the presentation of this lineup, there is a greater than 1 in 6 chance that Mr. Carter is going to be the person that's focused in upon because of his center position, because of what he's wearing, because of the fact that others are not brought to this prominent position within the photo array.
No, in the first display, the witness said he didn't recognize anybody, right?
He said he did not. He did not. Let's clear this up. He didn't tell the case agent that he recognized anybody. But he said when he looked at the second array, 3 months later, Carter's in the same position. And he makes this identification with such confidence. Then he says to the case agent, and actually I did recognize him back in the first array, and he was in the very same position in the first array.
But why didn't he say anything? Why didn't he speak up then?
At the first array? He said it was because he was afraid to acknowledge that he recognized the robber as Mr. Carter. However, he was cross-examined on this issue about did he make calls to the agent after the time had cooled and settled following the bank robbery. Did he call then and say, oh, yes, I recognized him? No, he didn't. He never made any calls. He never did anything. He didn't even tell the FBI agent, when the FBI agent first came to his door on December the 5th, that actually he had recognized the robber back in the earlier array. He didn't do that. It was only when he looked at this second array that he then told the agent he was now 100% sure that Mr. Carter was the bank robber and that actually he had recognized him in the earlier array when he had seen him the first time.
Now you have no objection to the second array, do you?
No, that's prepared by the FBI. I wish all photo arrays looked like that.
You know, to the extent that the first photo array was suggestive, it seems to point not to Mr. Carter, but to the naked man, to his left.
Well, it may
I mean, that's where my eyes went.
It may focus. The bank teller was male, so I don't know whether that matters or not. Our point is this. There is a focus to the center of the photo array, and that is why we wanted to call a witness regarding this matter. We're not saying that a viewer of that array might not have focused on Mr. Carter, on possibly another person in the array. We're not saying they had to pick Mr. Carter from the first array, but what we are saying, there was a greater than 1 in 6 chance that the viewer would be attracted to Mr. Carter. The very reason that we wanted to call the expert in this case was to discuss the suggestibility of the first array and the fact that the witness, having looked at that array and having believed at least that he, in his own mind, had made an identification, although he didn't disclose that, that by the time he came to look at the second array, 6 months later, that or 3 months later, that then he was confident. But we suggest, and I know our expert would have testified, that that confidence was underlied by this earlier identification procedure. And we believe that the suggestiveness of this created a situation so that viewing the second lineup did not provide enough reliability to assure that there was not a to prevent substantial likelihood of misidentification. Some of the other factors that need to be considered here are those set out in Niels versus Biggers, which is that there was little opportunity for the teller to view. When the robber came into the bank, there was a Saturday morning, there were long lines of customers. The teller was actually dealing with other people. That when the robbery actually went down, there was a gun, there was gun focus in this case. The teller was not only dealing with other customers, he was also telling another teller that they should get down because the robber was there. The robber immediately came across the bank, and after that, the teller never looked at him again because the teller went down on the floor and never looked up at the robber another time.
Yeah, but when he first came in the bank, he made a big scene, didn't he? And then left?
But the teller, he was at the end of the teller's line, and the teller was dealing with other customers.
But when somebody starts yelling that there's this, I don't know, we're complaining about the bank and it's disorganized and stomps out and that sort of thing, at least when he came back, wouldn't he be able to say it's the same guy?
The teller thought that was the same person that had been in the bank earlier. But we wanted to call this expert to go through these very criteria, the expert that we had regarding memory and identification. And he would have spoken about these things, the nature of the environment, what effect did the stress have upon the viewer, what about the post-event information that was provided to the witnesses, and how did those procedures affect the selection of Mr. Carter as the robber. And one thing I want to clear up, there is no credibility issue in this case as to the bank teller. We are not claiming that the bank teller lied. What we are suggesting, what we argued in the district court and argue here, is the bank teller was simply inaccurate, and it was because of the factors of the identification procedure and the initial confrontation in this case. We point out to this court that many aspects of perception and memory are not within common experience of the average juror.
Counsel, what was the harm in excluding the expert's testimony here? The eyewitness was cross-examined on all of these aspects of his identification, as I understand it, and there was DNA evidence that conclusively matched the defendant to a crack pipe that was found at the scene. There was footprint evidence that also did the same, and there was something else, the testimony of a cousin that placed him in the getaway car, I think. So if we let's say it was error to exclude the witness. What's the harm?
Okay. Here's where I believe the harm lies, is that, first of all, the cross-examination doesn't really cure this problem, because the types of things that the witness would have testified to are not the things that are easy to develop in cross-examination. In other words, if the witness has made a selection based upon bias, the witness doesn't know that. The witness believes he's being fully credible, truthful, and knows what he's doing. The fact that the witness had an opportunity to reconstruct his memory and then believe that he was very certain about who had been the robber in the bank is something that would have been developed by the expert in this case. The expert also would have discussed the very issues we're talking about here, of whether this was a biased photo procedure or not. The expert would have discussed this whole procedure of presenting photo arrays, where all the photo arrays are there at one time as opposed to the sequential. When all the photo arrays are there at one time, the witness is under a certain kind of pressure to select one person who most resembles the perpetrator of the offense. If it is a sequential lineup, one photo at a time, then what the viewer is being asked to make a decision, how closely this particular photo resembles the perpetrator. And that makes a lot of difference, and that is one of the main premises now when experts come to testify regarding identification in memory. There's another issue, the issue of the same agent being the person that admitted, that conducted these identification procedures. Those particular, that having that same agent runs a significant risk that there could be inadvertent cues given. I mean, states, New Jersey, I think, now has implemented a law saying the agent who is the case agent shouldn't be the purpose that's administering the identification procedure. As to the question of the DNA evidence had immense problems. It was a rough sample. I think the person that came from Cellmark said that. They had to do 3 extractions. They couldn't get anything the first time. They did a second extraction. They still couldn't get anything. Then they dilute the entire solution and bring it down to less than what it originally was. Then they say they have made a match. But at the same time, they've made matches for others. This is a family car. These are relatives in this car. They've matched a whole other person with this. And the expert from Cellmark was not in any position to say who was the last person that had put DNA on the crack pipe. So I don't think that the DNA evidence was conclusive. I also want to point out to the court, I believe the government's brief is mistaken in saying that Arsenal Syed, a person outside of the vehicle, identified Mr. Carter on transcripts 531 through 538. It is clear he only identified a license plate. He never made any attempt to identify the bank robber. Many fingerprints were recovered, and none of those correlated to Mr. Carter.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Hammerman?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Joel Hammerman. I'm here on behalf of the United States. As an initial matter, I think that the thing that's most important to remember here is that basically if you take a look at these photo spreads, you'll see that in that first photo spread there are six individuals depicted. They all
have but two of the pictures in the first photo array are so dark that they cannot reasonably be considered part of the array. Have we or any court ever upheld an array that contained only four pictures?
I don't have off the top of my head a case that I can cite to you to say that four pictures has been used as a successful photo array. I would submit, though, that the black and white photocopies that were provided do darken the picture, and in a sense the color pictures weren't near as dark. But the fact of the matter is that the witness, if you look at these photographs, they are like individuals. They're similar attributes. They're a similar type of photograph. They're glossy shots. They're from the arms underneath the arms up. These are comparable photographs. And the standard here, I think the standard that's getting lost is, the question is, was this array unduly suggestive? Did looking at this array, was an individual that had never seen the bank robber somehow immediately attracted to Mr. Carter? Mr. Carter's counsel makes the argument that by placing Mr. Carter in the bottom center position that you are, by definition, focused on Mr. Carter. That would turn every sixth photograph array into an unduly suggestive array. It would mean that somehow everyone is always drawn to that one photograph. There's no evidence for that in the record. There's no empirical evidence that suggests that. There was a six-person photo array. The witness looked at it. The witness told the agent at the time, "I don't see the bank robber." The witness at trial, though, admitted that, in fact, he immediately identified Mr. Carter as the bank robber when he looked at that array. The reason that he said that at the time, to answer your question, was that he was just a few days after the bank robbery. He was quite scary. He was at home. There was FBI agents at his home, and he thought that if he actually identified the bank robber, he'd be forced to come testify at trial, and he didn't want to do any of that. And so he denied seeing the bank robber. However, at trial, he said very clearly that, in fact, he had recognized Mr. Carter in that first array as the bank robber. And he said that he did so because he recognized him. The question, though, you go back to and you look at those first set of six pictures was it unduly suggestive? And I would submit to you that it's not. Even so, there is a three-month delay to the next time this particular witness is shown another photo array. Once again, it's a six-person photo array. Defense counsel says there's no objection whatsoever to that array in the style. The photographs themselves, apparently Mr. Carter's position in the lower bottom is the complaint in that he's the only individual in both arrays and that he's in the same position. But this court has found on numerous occasions that a witness can be shown successive photo arrays to try to identify the defendant of the perpetrator of a crime. It is found that in Harris. It is found that in Gregory Bray. It is something that has happened on numerous occasions. In this case, the defendant looked at that particular photo array, once again, immediately identified Mr. Carter as the bank robber, told the FBI agent just as much. At trial, the witness did not equivocate at all. He said that he was positive, that he was certain that that particular witness, that particular picture was of the defense, of the bank robber. And he said that he knew that not because of what array he had seen on just a few days following the actual bank robbery on September 6th, but of what had happened in the bank that day. As the defense counsel points out, there are factors that even if you had an unduly suggestive array, which I submit once again, this clearly was not. If it was suggestive, which I don't believe it clearly was not unduly suggestive. But even if you had one, you'd have to determine whether or not it was nevertheless a reliable identification. And then the factors that have been this court has looked to see that is, did the defendant or did the witness have an opportunity to view the defendant at the time of the crime?
Could we talk for a moment about the expert? Because the district court seemed to be saying that an expert on eyewitness testimony will never be helpful to a jury. And that doesn't seem like an exercise of discretion. That seems more like a ruling as a matter of law. So, I mean, in the record, can you tell us where he gave consideration to the individualized facts of this case and actually exercised his discretion? I don't want you to take a lot of time, but is it there?
Yeah, I believe that it is. The district court considered this issue very carefully prior to trial and found, looking at the arrays and hearing the arguments of both sides, that it believed that the proposed expert testimony in this case, having been given actually a sample of what this particular expert had said in, I believe, in past cases, that this case did not present an unusual or compelling situation in which the aid of an expert witness was required. The district court did look to this court's long precedent, a long line of cases that have strongly stated a disfavor of having expert witnesses on eyewitness identification. The district court said that it believed that this was not a case that fell outside of the norm, that fell in line with that long string of cases before this court, cases like Welch and Hall, and it decided, and Larkin and Daniels, and it said that it believed that the jury could make its own determination on whether or not this particular witness, Mr. Hernandez, had in fact viewed the defendant and made an identification in those photo arrays. And it did so in an order and opinion. The district court made that determination in an order and opinion that was dated, I believe, on 11/7/2003. With respect to going back to the factors that the district court would look at to determine, or that this court should look at to determine whether or not the witness's identification of the defendant as the bank robber was nonetheless reliable, even if it was unduly suggestive, which once again the government submits it was not, it was the witness's opportunity to view the defendant at the time of the crime. I would submit that if the court reads the transcript of the trial, the witness made it very clear that he had an opportunity to view the defendant. I know that defense counsel tries to color that here today. I would submit that the jury heard the witness's testimony. The jury made a determination whether or not that witness had an opportunity to view the defendant, and I would submit that, in fact, he did. The witness claimed that he noticed Mr. Carter when he first walked in the bank because he started shouting profanities. It's one thing to make a ruckus. It's another thing to start shouting profanities in a bank. It draws attention. And the witness noted that he looked at the defendant when he did that. He also noted that when the defendant walked back in the bank, pulled out a gun and started waving it around and ordered everyone in the bank to get down on the ground, he didn't. The witness did not. He stood and looked at the defendant. The defendant, noting the one person that was still standing and also a teller in the bank, walked up to that witness pointing a gun at him the entire time. He was looking at the defendant as he approached him. Clearly, that's a sufficient opportunity to view the individual, and that was the basis on making that eyewitness identification.
Counsel, before your time is up, would you address the sentencing issues?
Sure.
We have Booker issues in the case, as I understand it, but there's also some issues about whether the two enhancers were properly applied.
And I can address either of those, and I guess I'll start with the Booker issue, and that would be that I believe under this court's recent Palladino decision that, in fact, a Palladino remand is appropriate here if the court affirms on all other grounds. The government will concede that. As with respect to the two guideline issues that you've raised, there are, as you know, two objections to the application of the guidelines. One's for obstruction of justice. The defendant chose to take the stand in his case. He got on the stand and basically read from narratives that he had written, affidavits, if you will.
Yeah, but what specifically was his perjury on the first Star robbery? Because all of his testimony seemed to relate to the second robbery.
His testimony actually dealt primarily with the circumstances under which he gave his confession and wrote his statement. But in doing so, Your Honor, what he said was that he had been on a three-day binge. And that
Is there evidence that he wasn't on drugs or alcohol at the first Star robbery?
There is no evidence whether he was on drugs at the time of that robbery. But what the defendant was, in a sense, doing was he was trying to put a cloud over his entire confession, over his entire statement to the court. He was putting his credibility and his credibility about his actions over a three-day period, and he got on the stand and he clearly lied. And
his statement and his testimony, though, only related to the second bank robbery, not the first one. And is there any law to support the application of the perjury enhancer to a count on which the defendant doesn't perjure himself?
The defendant basically told a story, if you will, that he said that for 3 days straight that he was high, that he was drunk, that he was out of his mind.
Yeah, but what evidence is there that he wasn't out of his mind on drugs and alcohol?
He made a statement that that state of mind, if you will, lasted for a three-day period. At the time that he gave his confession, he was allegedly still in that state of mind. The government FBI agents that took the stand said that clearly was not the case. The district court made a finding that that was not the case. That
because he knew his Social Security number?
No, because the FBI agents said at the time that he was lucid, that he answered questions clearly, he seemed to understand what was going on, that he was not in a drug-induced state. And the defense actually tried to use this at the time of jury instructions. They asked for an intoxication instructions as to both bank robbery charges. They tried to stretch out this statement that related from the time of that first robbery to the time of his confession as a basis for an intoxication instruction. And so I'd submit that, in fact, he was lying about his state of mind at the time of his confession, and he tried to tie that all the way back. But I think what's most important here is this particular guideline enhancement, even if not applied to the first-star bank robbery, would not change the offense level that the defendant actually was sentenced under. Because of the grouping rules under the sentencing guidelines, if his offense level had been lowered under the first-star bank robbery by two offense levels, because the first American bank robbery had a higher offense level and it was within four offense levels, it did not increase the overall offense level that was the basis for a sentence. So it's really a non-issue in effect when it comes to what sentencing range would the defendant be subjected to for purposes of sentencing under then mandatory sentencing guidelines. Now, with respect to the other sentencing issue, the restraint of a victim teller, the defendant's made an argument that basically there has to be physical touching, constrainment of some sort, or confinement, literally locking someone in a room. And I'd submit that this court in Dobe didn't find that to be the case. There is a concept of construction, physical restraint. In this case, Mr. Carter pointed his gun at a teller. He basically had a sustained focus on that one specific teller. He forced her to move from one part of the bank to another. The district court made specific findings in this regard. He said that the victim could not move an inch of her own volition. She could not walk away. She could not do anything. Those were the findings of the district court. And basically what we have here is we have a victim that could not move except for the way that she was told to and in the manner that she was told to by the defendant.
Isn't that always the case in a bank robbery?
I would submit that there's nothing in the record that would suggest that, and I'd say that there is not. I mean, it is one thing to walk into a bank and say, freeze, or, you know, get down. And the courts have generally, that have addressed that issue, have said that might not be enough. There is a Ninth Circuit opinion that suggests that it might. This court in dicta suggested that alone might not be enough in Dobe. But that's not what we have here. What we have here is a sustained focus on one individual person, not everybody freeze or no one move.
It's the government's position that if a bank robber has that sort of sustained focus on a single teller in the course of a bank robbery, that that's sufficient to justify the application of the physical restraint. Is there anything more than that
here? He shepherded that particular victim from one part of the bank to another part of the bank.
From what part of the bank to another part?
From the vault to her teller drawer. He wanted her to go back up to the teller drawer so that she could open her drawer and he could get more money. And what initially happened is he jumped over the counter, he turned to the first teller and said, open your drawer, I want your money. She did as much. And then he said, open that drawer, and she said, I can't. And she basically then went back to the vault to get her coworker, the victim, and that became the focus of this particular enhancement. And she was crying, and she didn't want to go out, and she didn't want to go to her teller drawer. And she made that very clear. Mr. Carter then, who had already hopped over the teller counter, walked right up to that victim, within inches of her, according to the district court, and forced her under, you know, I would assume a threat of death, although not explicit. A gun pointed at a victim is very clear, I would submit to the court, and forced her to another part of the bank to open up her teller drawer. That sustained focus, that forcing of an individual to move. One does not have to put a rope around somebody and tie them up and drag them. If you put a gun in their face and you make them move, I submit to the court that is enough to apply the enhancement for the physical restraint of a victim. And that, under those circumstances, on the circumstances we have here, as this court has defined in Dobe, that's enough to apply this particular guideline enhancement. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thanks. How much time she got left? We've got about a minute to want to respond.
Just very clearly, the defense was particularly concerned with the court's rulings as to the issue of Mr. Carter's obstruction of justice. When the district court made its rulings, the district court talked about the fact that there had been a motion to suppress statements, that he had denied that motion. He talked about Mr. Carter's testimony during that motion and about a second agent that testified. We never filed a motion to suppress statements. The defendant never testified in a motion to suppress statements, and there never was testimony from two agents. Secondly, the things that Mr. Carter said about the agents, I believe, are consistent with what we normally hear taking place during interrogation. He said the agents planted ideas in his head. Law enforcement agents usually discuss things with suspects when they have them in custody. They ask them if they've done certain things. They wait to see if the person acknowledges it. There's nothing unusual about the agent doing that. And that may well be why Mr. Carter felt they had planted ideas in his head. He made it perfectly clear that he would not have made the statements to the agents if he had not been in the condition that he was in. And he never actually complained that the agents did anything to him. He said he just wanted to get away from them so that he could rest. The notes for obstruction specifically point out that the district court should be cognizant that incorrect testimony or statements sometimes may result from confusion, mistake, or faulty memory, and thus not all inaccurate testimony or statements necessarily reflect a willful attempt to obstruct justice. Mr. Carter never denied that he committed the first American bank robbery. Mr. Carter never was even asked nor spoke about the first Star Bank robbery. And based upon those things, and he never claimed that the agents lied to him or did anything coercive to him. He used the word, but he never claimed they did anything to him. The other point that we wish
to
bring
up. You have to wrap it up now.
Physical restraint?
Hurry up.
Okay. We want to point out that the victim who moved from the vault to the money drawer was not even in court, never testified as to what she thought occurred, that simply all you have here is a situation where the first teller goes to the vault, tells the second teller that the man wants the money from the money drawer. The next thing we know, the man is there. He is there, and he does have the gun. But there is no testimony that when they went from the vault to the money drawer that Mr. Carter was holding a weapon on anybody or making threats to the person or anything to that effect. And it's based the thrust of our argument here is what the guidelines really say with reference to this is it has to be physical. Physical, what do we mean by that? There has to be contact, physical contact, as the dictionary says, or there has to be some type of physical confinement. Neither of those situations were present.
Okay, thank you. The case will be taken under advisement.